In our last class, which I mentioned a few moments ago, was some time ago, we considered the life of a very important individual, and I want to begin there in our study this evening. But as we considered the life and the times of Innocent III, who ruled as the Bishop of Rome from 1198 to 1216 A.D., and I've written his name here on the board for you, so you can copy that if you'd like. Innocent III was, in the opinion of many church historians, the most powerful of the medieval popes. And Innocent III was really the one who championed the claims of the medieval papacy. Now, some of the claims you're probably familiar with. Innocent III championed the claim that the Pope is the vicar of Christ. And when we think about the Roman Catholic claim that the Pope is vicar of Christ today, we think about it in the sense of his proclamation that the Pope is in fact the spokesman for Christ. But to Innocent III, the claim that the Pope was the vicar of Christ really meant much more than that. It meant that the Pope is the presence of Christ on earth, that he's not just the spokesman for Jesus Christ, but he is the very authority of Jesus Christ in an individual. Not only that, but Innocent III championed a doctrine known as the plenitude of powers. I'll bring that on the board here for you. The plenitude of powers. Has anybody heard that terminology used before? It might be totally new to you. But very simply put, Innocent III said that the Pope contains the plenitude of powers. In other words, he contains not just power over spiritual things, but he also possesses power over political things. That not only does he direct and instruct and overshepherd the church, the people of God, but he also has a role in directing and overseeing and shepherding the political realms and the political process as well. And so I think you can see very quickly that Innocent III claimed a great deal of power for the papacy. He's really the one that forwarded those claims, and he's really the one who established many of the claims that Roman Catholicism forwards, even in our own day. And so under Innocent III, the Roman Catholic Church solidified its might. This is why we really need to start here. The Roman Catholic Church solidified its might. And of course, as a result of these actions by Innocent III and his successors, reform in the church was truly opposed and the flow of the gospel was hindered. Yet while Innocent III and his medieval successors managed to solidify the Roman Catholic Church's claims and earthly powers, there were, even at this time, and again, I want you to just note this very simple timeline I have up here in terms of when Pope Innocent III was living. Even at this particular time, by his most wise and holy providence, was going to bring about significant change in the course of human history and ultimately bring about what you and I lovingly refer to as the Protestant Reformation. So this is where we're going to focus our attention this summer, Lord willing. And that is upon those persons, developments, and events that preceded or which gave birth to the Protestant Reformation. And I believe that what we'll see this summer is that the Protestant Reformation was not a movement or a religious upheaval that just appeared out of nowhere for no rhyme and for no reason and with no warning for its opponents. But rather, God actually announced its arrival in various ways. And we're going to examine some of those ways. We're going to focus on what I'm calling precursors to the Protestant Reformation. precursors to the Protestant Reformation. And these are the themes that we're going to look at. We're going to look at some early Reformed movements, which is what we're going to begin this evening. We're going to look at the Renaissance and the effect of the Renaissance, culturally, socially, and religiously. We're going to look at the rise of Christian humanism. And we're going to study very briefly Erasmus, because he plays a very key part and has a key role at this particular time in history. And then we're going to also look at the ruinous condition of the Roman Catholic Church. And when I deal with that, I'm going to try to be as objective as possible. I'm not going to use Protestant sources, but I'm going to actually quote from Roman Catholic sources that tell us what the condition of the church in Rome was like at this particular period in history. And Martin Luther and the birth of the Protestant Reformation. And we'll look at Luther, the man and the minister, Luther, the controversialist and the reluctant reformer, and then Luther as the father of a movement and, of course, his lasting legacy. Today we're going to begin our studies with a look at some early Reformed movements. Because even before the appearance of Luther and his fellow reformers in the 15th, 16th centuries, there were Reformed movements within the church. And although these Reformed movements or reforming movements were often small, these movements nevertheless sowed the seeds. In fact, I want us to just kind of use our imagination here. We have very hard ground out there. These early Reformed movements sowed the seed that would take root and over time would be watered and eventually would spring forth and bear fruit. In fact, I would encourage us to look at the Protestant Reformation in that manner. It did not happen just overnight. It just didn't plant the seed one day and walk out and find a full-grown tree the next. No, the seed was planted hundreds of years earlier, and it was faithfully watered. And it eventually, in time, in God's providence, sprang forth and began to bear fruit. And the first early Reformed movement that I want us to consider together is that of John Wycliffe and the Lollards. Wycliffe's teachings would have a profound, and I mean profound, impact on his own generation and on many generations to follow. But many of the reformers that we love and enjoy and have learned so much from felt a personal debt to the labors of John Wycliffe, even though he may have lived hundreds of years prior to their lives. In fact, Wycliffe was the first to raise his voice for Reformation in England. And for this reason, Wycliffe has been called the morning star of the Reformation. The morning star of the Reformation. Now I want to engage you a little bit this afternoon. Can anybody tell me what a morning star is, or the significance of a morning star? Okay, yeah, a morning star is a star that is visible in the eastern sky just before sunrise. A morning star is an indicator that the sun will soon be rising. And so if we think of Whitfield in that sense, we can see what an important role he actually played in regards to the Reformation. Whitfield has also been called the father of the English Bible. Father of the English Bible. And we'll discover why he is called the father of the English Bible in a short time. Therefore, if we are to rightly understand the conditions before the Reformation and the reasons for the Reformation, we need to know something of Wycliffe and his varied contributions. And the majority of information that I'll share on Wycliffe is taken from two sources. So if you want to do some further reading on Wycliffe, let me give you these two sources. One, I'm going to quote extensively from N.R. Needham's book, entitled 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, Volume 2. That's N.R. Needham's book, 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, Volume 2. And J.H. Merle Daubonnet's book. That's J.H. Merle Daubonnet. It's a French name. If you want to know the spelling, I'll give it to you later. And his book is called The Reformation in England. And I'll be quoting from Volume 1. And I believe that this is still published, or may have been published most recently by Banner of True Trust. So I'd really highly commend those two resources to you. Let's consider Wycliffe's life beginning with the early years. John Wycliffe was born in Yorkshire in northern England in the year 1330. Growing up, he was a good student, and at age 16, he went and studied at Oxford University. He was such an excellent student at Oxford University that he became known as Floss Oxonian. Now, that's obviously Latin phrase. Does anybody know what it means? Do you want to take a guess what it might mean? Floss Oxani says something of his skills and his promise. I probably shouldn't test you like this because it's difficult. I wouldn't be able to guess it myself. It simply means the flower of Oxford. He was known as the Flower of Oxford. That shows something of his academic promise and his abilities. It's also important that we understand that Oxford at that particular time was really a birthplace for reform and protest. So by going to Oxford University at that particular time, John Wycliffe would be exposed to some of the early thought involved in the Protestant Reformation. Some of the early calls for reforms and some of the early protests concerning the abuses of the Roman Catholic Church. While studying at Oxford, Wycliffe, as I mentioned, was an outstanding student. And after he completed his studies at Oxford, he became involved in parish ministry and also achieved fame as a lecturer in theology and in philosophy. In time, Whitfield's abilities were so apparent that he soon became a religious advisor to the court of the English monarch, who at that time was King Edward III. King Edward III. Now, no doubt one of the reasons why Wycliffe was chosen for this position of religious advisor was that Wycliffe had by this time not only embraced Reformed theology, but he'd also developed theological views which were not only opposed to the Church of Rome, but also supportive of the interests of the English monarchy. Not only opposed to the Church of Rome, but also supportive of the interests of the English monarchy. For example, Wycliffe taught that the Church of Rome had no rightful claim over England, although the Roman Catholic Church claimed that she did have rightful claim to England, since in 1213, an English monarch by the name of John surrendered England to Pope Innocent in that year. So to go back to Pope Innocent III, in that particular year, 1613, Pope Innocent III selected an archbishop over England. the English monarchy, and the English monarch at that time, King John, rejected that appointment. And as a result of that, a battle, a struggle ensued between King John and between Innocent III. Innocent III tried to strong arm John into accepting the appointment of this archbishop. King John refused, and ultimately, remember the claims of Innocent III. Ultimately, Innocent III appealed to the other political powerhouses in Europe and actually staged a crusade to march against England and to dethrone King John. That says something about the power of Innocent III at that time. And to prevent that from happening, King John, in the year 1213, surrendered England to Innocent III. So, from 1213 until this time that we're talking about now, in the life of John Wycliffe, the Roman Catholic Church clearly believed that they had a rightful claim over England. Well, Wycliffe taught that the Church of Rome did not have a rightful claim over England. Rather, Whitfield taught that God is the only true source of authority, and that God had delegated his authority over secular affairs to the monarchy. Now, does this sound familiar in terms of his political understanding? Is there any similarities in Wycliffe's thought here at this early age and the way that maybe you and I as Americans think about the political process?
Actually, the basis for it is an avoidance of that sort of control.
And it's interesting that that thought has happened, you know, as early as Wycliffe's day. So we sometimes think of that distinction between the church's authority over spiritual matters and the state's authority over secular matters as being uniquely American in some ways, but it certainly is not uniquely American. Okay? This was clearly in the teaching of Wycliffe. Wycliffe also believed that the monarchy, if it served God faithfully, could ensure God's blessings upon the realm, and even act to ensure the moral integrity of the state, and in some extreme cases, of the church as well. Now, I think you can see by how I carefully worded that, that there could eventually be a conflict. In fact, Wycliffe went so far as to declare that if bishops in the church failed to live pure and blameless lives, the monarchy had the right to strip them of their goods and of their possessions. Needless to say, the Roman Catholic Church did not appreciate that position, but King Edward III was certainly in favor of such a view. So that kind of gives you an idea of the political environment and also of Wycliffe's political views. Any questions about that? Yes?
I have a minus 10.
Oh, you mean the monarch?
Yes.
Okay, I hope I stated that correctly. It should be King Edward III. Is that what I said? Okay, King Edward III. Yeah, that's a great question. It's a little later. Yeah. It's a good question. Definitely. The Roman Catholic Church is still very, very much in power in England at this time. Yes.
Well, it seems like King John surrendered up, I suppose, to Rome without even getting up a fight.
I wouldn't say that he surrendered England without giving up a fight. I think John just realized the forces which had been amassed under the influence of Innocent III, and realized that in those days it would not be out of the question for a monarch to be removed by force if he were viewed to be at odds with the church. And so he did resist for a while, and resisted well, but ultimately, when faced with a crusading army coming into his realm for the specific purpose of removing him, he finally gave way, conceded, and in a very real sense, surrendered control over to England, because by doing so, he was in essence saying, okay, Innocent III, you have not just spiritual authority, but you have political authority over my realm also. Any other comments or questions? Yes.
But would it be such that Innocent III might have been able to expect some help from loyal Roman Catholics within England?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Royal Roman Catholics within England as well would be more than willing to assist Innocent III and any invading forces in overthrowing a rebellious monarch. These are very different times, needless to say. And as I stated on the board, Innocent III was a very powerful medieval pope. And he had tremendous political influence. And no doubt many other monarchs were indebted to him or certainly wanted to win his favor and would have been willing to go to war if Innocent III had asked them to do so. Any other questions or comments? Okay. So we see that Wycliffe thought that the Church of Rome had no rightful claim over England. Also in time, Wycliffe spoke out against the Pope. In fact, if you're looking at your outlines, this is where we begin his role as a reformer. Wycliffe spoke out against the Pope. Wycliffe declared, "England belongs not to the Pope. The Pope is but a man, subject to sin. The Christ is the Lord of Lords, and this kingdom is held directly and solely of Christ alone." And of the Roman Catholic clergy, Wycliffe accused them of having banished the Holy Scriptures and the Gospel from England, and of living morally corrupt and greedy lives, which also undermined the Gospel. Now, you can only imagine what kind of alarm and stir these declarations caused. In fact, in February of 1377, Wycliffe was summoned to appear before a religious tribunal in London to answer for his views. This tribunal, headed by a bishop by the name of Courtney, would have taken action against Wycliffe, but the son of King Edward III, his name was John of Gaunt, intervened on Wycliffe's behalf and prevented the tribunal from harming Wycliffe. Soon after, in May of that same year, the Pope, now there's a different Pope on the scene in Wycliffe's day, remember Innocent III is back in this time frame. The Pope in Wycliffe's day is Gregory the 11th. In May of that same year, Gregory the 11th summoned Wycliffe to Rome to answer for his errors. What do you think Wycliffe did?
He refused to comply.
And no doubt his reasons for refusing to comply were what we just stated. The Pope has no authority over England. And if the Pope has no authority over England, he has no authority over me, and so I have no obligation to comply. Then again in January of 1378, and don't worry about getting all these dates. If you want them later, I'll give them to you. It's more important that you just kind of flow with the development of the events here. Again in January 1378, the Archbishop of Canterbury organized another tribunal in London in an attempt to convict Wycliffe. But this time, an angry mob of London citizens broke up the meeting and would not allow Wycliffe to be arrested, because by this time, John Wycliffe had become a national hero of sorts. And why do you think that was the case?
Again, the separation of the English from their own national pride there.
Right, national pride, sure.
Well, they saw the clergy.
Exactly.
For
absolutely, great, Mike. Yeah, they were aware of the corruption of the clergy in that day. They were, as Englishmen, quite frustrated with the idea of being under the control of the Pope, being under control of Rome. And they wanted to have basically nothing to do with the Roman Catholic Church at that time. So, as Mike said, you know, here comes one of their own men, one of their own kind. He steps into the breach and he begins to stand up for England. And of course we have English nationalism here, but most importantly for the good of the church also. Yes, right. Well, as I mentioned earlier, you make an outstanding point. As I mentioned earlier, when Wycliffe began to speak out against Rome's claim to England, and the king's right as an authority over secular matters, he was welcomed into the king's court, so to speak. He was a welcome advisor. And kings would not hesitate to bring persuasive men and even persuasive theologians for their cause. But I think we'll also find out historically that they were also willing to release those men when it became politically expedient. Because again, these are very, very difficult times. Some of these monarchs were willing to fight to a certain extent, but they were not willing to give up the crown. And so some of these reformers, to be honest with you, became expendable. And they were useful. Let's not ignore the providence of God. I mean, God is in control. God is using them. But from a human standpoint, speaking on behalf of the monarchy, they were useful for the monarchy. But if times got difficult and it looked like they might face an attempt to overthrow the monarchy or something like that, then they would quickly turn against them. Send them away. Any other comments or questions about that? Okay. So, Wycliffe is rescued by an angry mob of London citizens. These events only serve to inspire Wycliffe more. And he began to publish his views on other important doctrines also. For example, shortly after this last tribunal failed in January of 1378, Wycliffe wrote a work entitled The Truth of Holy Scripture. The Truth of Holy Scripture. This is a very, very important work. It's a shame that most of us are not even familiar with it. But considering the time in which it came out and considering its content, it was a very, very significant work in that day. In this book, Wycliffe argued that the Bible is the only source of Christian doctrine, and that Christians have a right to test all the teachings of the church, all the teachings of the church fathers, and all the teachings of the ecumenical councils by the Bible. Now, We're familiar with this claim that the Bible has that authority. We're living, of course, after the Reformation. But I want you to keep in mind how many years this is prior to the Reformation. In fact, I drew a little timeline here. Look at when Wycliffe is living, and look at when Martin Luther lived, and of course when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of Castle Church in Wittenberg. There's many years come before Luther comes on the scene. So Wycliffe is really ahead of his time. I mean, he's espousing views and insisting upon rights for individual Christians long before anyone was willing to seriously contemplate the legitimacy of these arguments. Okay, so we can see how important that was. Also, Wycliffe in this book argued that the Bible should be translated into English. And not just English, Wycliffe said, but the native tongues of all peoples. So here, at this early date, again, we're talking about 1378, Wycliffe is making an impassioned appeal here to make the Bible accessible to all peoples in their own languages so that the peoples can test all the teachings of the church, of the church fathers, and of course of the ecumenical councils. Needless to say, this book was very, very controversial. In fact, you can only imagine how the archbishops, the cardinals, and maybe the Pope himself reacted when they got wind of this book, or when they saw this book in print. And this is a strong attack against the Roman Catholic Church and all of its claims. Because basically what Wycliffe is saying, the church needs to be measured according to Scripture. Then in 1379, Wycliffe wrote a book called The Power of the Pope. And in this book, Wycliffe claimed that the papacy was of human origin, not divine. And he also declared, and to my knowledge, he's the first one to put this in print. I may be wrong, but I could not find any earlier statements in writing to this effect. But he also stated that all the popes, not just the bad ones, but also the good ones, were antichrist. Now, we're familiar with Luther making those statements, right? And maybe you were under the impression that Luther was the first one to make those statements. But Luther was not.
So you say those two books were in fact the 95 Theses of the day? I mean, they're probably equal to that?
I would say, you know, in the Providence of God, obviously the 95 Theses began a discussion that was unparalleled, I think. But there is a sense in which these are like Wycliffe's
preamble.
95 Theses. This is the essence of Wycliffe's claims against Rome in writing. And he's just basically taking the Pope on in terms of his power and saying, you know, all these claims that Innocent III and others after him have been setting forth, that the Pope has this turn to the powers, it's not true. Because the papacy is not of divine origin. It's of human origin. It's a human institution. Yes?
Did he argue against in Matthew 16 interpretation and went to Latin languages?
Absolutely, yes. He would argue about, you know, the claim that that the church has the keys to the kingdom, that the Pope sits upon the chair of Peter. All of those, sure, would be a part of Rome's arguments, that the Pope did possess the plenitude of power. That would be the spiritual aspect, sitting on Peter's throne. But Wycliffe is saying, you know, that throne is made of papier-mâché, basically. It's of human invention. It has no divine authority. And all of those popes who say that it does, or did, and even the pope who's living right now, who claims to possess this power, they're all antichrists. Then in 1390, Wycliffe wrote his most controversial work. This is a work that would lose him the support of the English monarchy. It would lose him the support of the English nobility. It would even lose him the support of his dear university, Oxford University. This work was entitled On the Eucharist. On the Eucharist. In this book, Wycliffe rejected the Roman Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation. He rejected the Roman Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation. Now, everybody here understands what the doctrine of transubstantiation teaches. Anybody here who does not understand what that doctrine teaches? Okay, transubstantiation just, again, teaches that in the Mass, the elements of bread and wine are literally and actually turned into the flesh and the blood of Jesus Christ. Instead, Wycliffe taught that Christ's flesh and blood were truly present in the bread and wine in a spiritual manner. In a spiritual manner. And again, I may be wrong. I cannot find any indication that I am in what I've read. To my knowledge, he was the first one to actually put this position in print. Now, obviously, Wycliffe's position is adopted by later reformers, isn't it? I'm not saying they adopted it simply because Wycliffe adopted it, but we see the position of later reformers. And obviously, this was not the view of Luther, was it? Right. But Wycliffe's view is certainly seen in what other reformers view of the Lord's Supper. A reformer very dear to our hearts.
Sounds like Calvin.
Calvin. Absolutely. You see Calvin's view of the Lord's Supper here. Or Wycliffe's view, later seen in the position of John Calvin. That, yeah, Christ is present in the elements. We're not saying that they're elements that have no meaning whatsoever. Christ is indeed present in them, but in a spiritual manner. And when we feed at the Lord's table, we feed spiritually. We drink spiritually. Now, in response to this book, the Roman Catholic Church declared Wycliffe a dangerous heretic. A dangerous heretic. And as I implied just a few moments ago, the English monarchy and the nobility turned against him. You ask, why did they turn against him? Well, to be honest with you, I think they primarily turned against him because while they were willing to entertain many of Wycliffe's thoughts thus far, they weren't willing to go that far. I mean, the doctrine of transubstantiation was well ingrained, even within England at this time. It's very possible the monarchy did truly believe in transubstantiation, and Wycliffe's views would seem very, very radical. Or it could be that the English monarchy saw that, Wycliffe had really gone too far this time, and that the repercussions would be just tremendous. And so they disassociated themselves from him. And Oxford University actually expelled his followers. Thus, Wycliffe retired to a place called Lutterworth in the Midlands of England. And he labored quietly as a parish priest. So we see Wycliffe bursts upon the scene. He's used of God to make these proclamations. He puts his views in writing. His views are promoted, create quite a response. He wins the hearts and the favor of his countrymen. But because he continues to push his views too far, he begins to lose much of that support, at least on the level of the monarchy and the nobility is concerned. Now we move on to Wycliffe's final years. Yes.
Being Roman Catholic, former Roman Catholic, it seems like that, when you look at all the other things that they isn't really thinking on air, it's kind of a problem as much as the fish doctrine. This one tends to undo their entire, if it was sophisticated Catholic, the idea that you need a Catholic priest to transubstantiate your birth. So
right.
If you can't transubstantiate, he's no good. You basically undo the priesthood, which is in every parish, in every county, in every.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point. Yeah, there was a whole lot more at stake than just the theology of the Eucharist in terms of what the elements consisted of. But yeah, the Roman Catholic priesthood was tied to that. The whole Roman sacramental system was tied to the doctrine of transubstantiation. You're right. And to say that transubstantiation was wrong did not occur. It really struck at the very heart of the Roman priesthood and the sacramental system. That's a good point, a really good point. And you can see why, given this early period, some maybe were not willing to go that far at this point. Again, we're early. We're early. We're talking about early reform movements here. Okay? Pre-Reformation movements. So again, going to his final years. During the last 3 years of Wycliffe's life, he continued to set forth his views in popular pamphlets, and he actually put some of his views in Latin, some more scholarly works for the scholars to read and to discuss. He also organized a team of men to translate the Latin Vulgate Bible into English. The Latin Vulgate Bible into English. And the first complete Bible was finished in the year 1384. The first complete English Bible. Now, it's not translated from Greek and Hebrew. It's translated from the Latin Vulgate. Okay? That just happens to be the same year, if you'll look at your notes here, the same year that Wycliffe died. Lawless. And this is an interesting term. Most historians believe that this was a derogatory term. The word lawless actually means mumblers.
Probably
what does that imply?
Probably less than they don't know what they're talking about.
You don't know what they're talking about? Sure. That's inherent within that term, I think. I think the idea here is that they are completely uneducated. They don't know what they're talking about. They're just mumbling a bunch of doctrines because they really have no education to speak of. They're not cultured men. They're not educated men. They're not gifted men. They're just a bunch of people that Wycliffe gathered together and told them what to say, and they just go out and mumble. Okay? What was that?
Parrots.
Yeah, they're just mumblers. So again, the idea is don't listen to them. You know, they're not approved messengers of the gospel. They're not priests who are ordained by the Roman Catholic Church. They're just laymen. They're just uneducated mumblers. Don't listen to their message. But as we'll discuss in a few seconds, they were anything but mumblers. Wycliffe died in the year 1384. And was buried in the Lutterworth Church graveyard, where his bones rested, so to speak, until Roman Catholic authorities, who were still angry with his views some 34 years later, dug his bones up again, burned them for heresy, and threw the ashes into the River Swift. Some of you probably already knew that fact concerning Wycliffe's remains. And many have pontificated or suggested that that was a very symbolic act. Because what would happen if you threw his ashes into the River Swift? What would then happen to his ashes? Symbolically.
scattered all over.
Scattered teachings all over the place. And really, that's what happened. Word got out, of course, of Wycliffe's death, and Wycliffe's teachings continued to be promoted, and then, of course, word got out about Wycliffe's having been dug up again and unceremoniously treated. Thus, though he was dead, Wycliffe still spoke, and he continues to do so today. Now, let's talk about his followers, the Lollards, real quick. In the years following Wycliffe's death, the Lollards grew in numbers, and some of them became prominent members of English society. In fact, in 1394, a group of Lollard members of Parliament published a manifesto called The 12 Conclusions, a summary of Wycliffe's teachings as well. And I don't want to read all of them, but maybe we can just read a few of them here very, very quickly.
But when the Church of England began to go mad after temporalities, like its great stepmother, the Roman Church, and churches were authorized to, by appropriation in diverse places, faith, hope, and charity began to flee from our church.
Okay, does everybody understand what they're saying there? That when the church began to go after earthly riches, just like its stepmother, the Roman Catholic Church, did, then all those wonderful virtues, faith, hope, and charity began to flee from the church. Somebody read number two real quick. Yes.
The unusual priesthood which began in Rome pretended to be a power more lofty than it was, not that priesthood which Christ ordained for the apostles.
Okay, powerful statement there. Again, statement that goes to the very heart of the Roman Catholic priesthood and sacramental system. Somebody read number four real quick. How about number four real quickly?
That the pretended miracle of the sacrament of bread drives all men but a few to idolatry, because they think the body of Christ, which is never away from heaven, took our power of the priest's word being closed specifically in a little bread that shows people.
Okay. And then somebody read five.
That the exorcisms and blessings performed over wine, bread, water, and oil, salt, wax, and incense, the stones of the altar, the church walls, over clothing, cross, and pilgrim's staves are the genuine performance of necromancy rather than of secret theology.
Does anybody know what necromancy is? It's sorcery or black magic. Yeah. Boy, that's a powerful claim, isn't it? Sorcery or black magic. So this gives you an idea of what the conclusions of the Lollards were, who, again, rose to prominent places within English society shortly after Wycliffe's death. But in 1399, a political upheaval took place within the English monarchy in favor of Roman Catholicism. So we've talked before about how things switch back and forth. And there was a family that rose to a position of power. They were the Lancaster family. They wanted to win the approval of the church at Rome. So they passed a law which made the burning of heretics legal again in England. And they immediately came after the Lollards. And as a result, hundreds of Lollards were imprisoned and many of them were burnt at the stake. But the Lollards survived mostly by going underground. And when the Protestant Reformation came to England, they were its earliest and most zealous supporters. So any questions about John Wycliffe and the Lollards? Any questions at all?
How did Lollards survive? They went underground and then over time they emerged again?
Yes, exactly. They went underground. And they met privately in homes and wherever they could for many years. And then as more sympathy developed for the Reformation, then they took a more prominent role. And so when the Reformation really took place, it was like this this underground group of people who were ready to run when the starting gun was sounded, so to speak.